Planck had no justification for his pivotal introduction of lumpy energy. Beyond the fact that it worked, neither he nor anyone else could give a compelling reason for why it should be true. As the physicist George Gamow once said, it was as if nature allowed one to drink a whole pint of beer or no beer at all, but nothing in between. In 1905, Einstein found an explanation, and for this insight, he was awarded the 1921 Nobel Prize in Physics. Einstein came up with his explanation by puzzling over something known as the photoelectric effect. The German physicist Heinrich Hertz, in 1887, was the first to find that when electromagnetic radiation, light, shines on certain metals, they emit electrons. By itself, this is not particularly remarkable. Metals have the property that some of their electrons are only loosely bound within atoms, which is why they are such good conductors of electricity. When light strikes the metallic surface, it relinquishes its energy, much as it does when it strikes the surface of your skin, causing you to feel warmer. This transferred energy can agitate electrons in the metal, and some of the loosely bound ones can be knocked clear off the surface. But the strange features of the photoelectric effect become apparent when one studies more detailed properties of the ejected electrons. At first sight, you would think that as the intensity of the light, its brightness, is increased, the speed of the ejected electrons will also increase, since the impinging electromagnetic wave has more energy. But this does not happen. Rather, the number of ejected electrons increases, but their speed stays fixed. On the other hand, it has been experimentally observed that the speed of the ejected electrons does increase if the frequency of the impinging light is increased, and, equivalently, their speed decreases if the frequency of the light is decreased. For electromagnetic waves in the visible part of the spectrum, an increase in frequency corresponds to a change in color from red to orange to yellow to green to blue to indigo and finally to violet. Frequencies higher than that of violet are not visible and correspond to ultraviolet and subsequently X-rays. Frequencies lower than that of red are also not visible and correspond to infrared radiation. In fact, as the frequency of the light used is decreased, there comes a point when the speed of the emitted electrons drops to zero and they stop being ejected from the surface, regardless of the possibly blinding intensity of the light source. For some unknown reason, the color of the impinging light beam, not its total energy, controls whether or not electrons are ejected, and if they are, the energy they have. To understand how Einstein explained these puzzling facts, let's go back to the warehouse, which has now heated up to a balmy 80 degrees. Imagine that the landlord, who hates children, requires everyone under the age of 15 to live in the sunken basement of the warehouse, which the adults can view from a huge wraparound balcony. Moreover, the only way any of the enormous number of basement-bound children can leave the warehouse is if they can pay the guard an 85-cent exit fee. This landlord is such an ogre. The adults, who at your urging have arranged the collective wealth by denomination as described above, can give money to the children only by throwing it down to them from the balcony. Let's see what happens. The person carrying pennies begins by tossing a few down, but this is far too meager a sum for any of the children to be able to afford the departure fee. And because there is an essentially infinite sea of children, all ferociously fighting in a turbulent tumult for the falling money, even if the penny-entrusted adult throws enormous numbers down, no individual child will come anywhere near collecting the 85 he or she needs to pay the guard. The same is true for the adults carrying nickels, dimes, and quarters. Although each tosses down a staggeringly large total amount of money, any single child is lucky if he or she gets even one coin. Most get nothing at all. And certainly no child collects the 85 cents necessary to leave. But then, when the adult carrying dollars starts throwing them down, even comparatively tiny sums, dollar by single dollar, those lucky children who catch a single bill are able to leave immediately. Notice, though, that even as this adult loosens up and throws down barrels of dollar bills, the number of children who are able to leave increases enormously, but each has exactly 15 cents left after paying the guard. This is true regardless of the total number of dollars tossed. Here's what all this has to do with the photoelectric effect. Based on the experimental data reviewed above, Einstein suggested incorporating Planck's lumpy picture of wave energy into a new description of light. A light beam, according to Einstein, should actually be thought of as a stream of tiny packets, tiny particles of light, which were ultimately christened photons by the chemist Gilbert Lewis, an idea we made use of in our example of the light clock of Chapter 2. To get a sense of scale, according to this particle view of light, a typical 100-watt bulb emits about 100 billion billion, 10 to the 20th power, photons per second. Einstein used this new conception to suggest a microscopic mechanism underlying the photoelectric effect. An electron is knocked off a metallic surface, he proposed, if it gets hit by a sufficiently energetic photon. And what determines the energy of an individual photon? To explain the experimental data, Einstein followed Planck's lead and proposed that the energy of each photon is proportional to the frequency of the light wave, with the proportionality factor being Planck's constant. Now, like the children's minimum departure fee, the electrons in a metal must be jostled by a photon possessing a certain minimum energy in order to be kicked off the surface. As with the children fighting for money, it is extremely unlikely that any one electron gets hit by more than one photon. Most don't get hit at all. But if the impinging light beam's frequency is too low, its individual photons will lack the punch necessary to eject electrons. Just as no children can afford to leave regardless of the huge total number of coins the adults shower upon them, no electrons are jostled free regardless of the huge total energy embodied in the impinging light beam if its frequency, and thus the energy of its individual photons, is too low. But just as children are able to leave the warehouse as soon as the monetary denomination showered upon them gets large enough, electrons will be knocked off the surface as soon as the frequency of the light shown on them, its energy denomination, gets high enough. Moreover, just as the dollar-entrusted adult increases the total money thrown down by an increasing number of individual bills tossed, the total intensity of a light beam of a chosen frequency is increased by increasing the number of photons it contains. And just as more dollars result in more children being able to leave, more photons result in more electrons being hit and knocked clear off the surface. But notice that the leftover energy that each of these electrons has after ripping free of the surface depends solely on the energy of the photon that hits it. And this is determined by the frequency of the light beam, not its total intensity. Just as children leave the basement with 15 cents no matter how many dollar bills are thrown down, each electron leaves the surface with the same energy, and hence the same speed, regardless of the total intensity of the impinging light. More total money simply means more children can leave. More total energy in the light beam simply means more electrons are knocked free. If we want children to leave the basement with more money, we must increase the monetary denomination tossed down. If we want electrons to leave the surface with greater speed, we must increase the frequency of the impinging light beam. That is, we must increase the energy denomination of the photons we shine on the metallic surface. This is precisely in accord with the experimental data. The frequency of the light, its color, determines the speed of the ejected electrons. The total intensity of the light determines the number of ejected electrons. And so Einstein showed that Planck's guess of lumpy energy actually reflects a fundamental feature of electromagnetic waves. They are composed of particles, photons, that are little bundles or quanta of light. The lumpiness of the energy embodied by such waves is due to their being composed of lumps. Einstein's insight represented great progress, but, as we shall now see, The story is not as tidy as it might appear. Is it a wave or is it a particle? Everyone knows that water, and hence water waves, are composed of a huge number of water molecules. So is it really surprising that light waves are also composed of a huge number of particles, namely photons? It is. But the surprise is in the details. You see, more than 300 years ago, Newton proclaimed that light consisted of a stream of particles, so the idea is not exactly new. However, some of Newton's colleagues, most notably the Dutch physicist Christian Huygens, disagreed with him and argued that light is a wave. The debate raged, but ultimately experiments carried out by the English physicist Thomas Young in the early 1800s showed that Newton was wrong. A version of Young's experimental setup was known as the double-slit experiment. Feynman was fond of saying that all of quantum mechanics can be gleaned from carefully thinking through the implications of this single experiment. So it's well worth discussing. Light is shown on a thin solid barrier in which two slits are cut. A photographic plate records the light that gets through the slits. Brighter areas of the photograph indicate more incident light. The experiment consists of comparing the images on photographic plates that result when either or both of the slits in the barrier are kept open and the light source is turned on. If the left slit is covered and the right slit is open, the photograph shows a single vertical pattern on the right. This makes good sense, since the light that hits the photographic plate must pass through the only open slit and will therefore be concentrated around the right part of the photograph. Similarly, if the right slit is covered and the left slit open, the photograph will show a pattern on the left. If both slits are open, Newton's particle picture of light leads to the prediction that the photographic plate will show two patterns, left and right. In essence, if you think of Newton's corpuscles of light as if they were little pellets you fire at the wall, the ones that get through will be concentrated in the two areas that line up with the two slits. The wave picture of light, on the contrary, leads to a very different prediction for what happens when both slits are open. Let's see this. Imagine for a moment that rather than dealing with light waves, we use water waves. The result we will find is the same, but water is easier to think about. When water waves strike the barrier, outgoing circular water waves emerge from each slit, much like those created by throwing a pebble into a pond. It is simple to try this using a cardboard barrier with two slits in a pan of water. As the waves emerging from each slit overlap with each other, something quite interesting happens. If two wave peaks overlap, the height of the water wave at that point increases. It's the sum of the heights of the two individual peaks. If two wave troughs overlap, the depth of the water depression at that point is similarly increased. And finally, if a wave peak emerging from one slit overlaps with a wave trough emerging from the other, they cancel each other out. In fact, this is the idea behind fancy noise-eliminating headphones. They measure the shape of the incoming sound wave and then produce another whose shape is exactly opposite, leading to a cancellation of the undesired noise. In between these extreme overlaps, peaks with peaks, troughs with troughs, and peaks with troughs are a host of partial height augmentations and cancellations. Locations of significant jostling are where wave peaks, or troughs, from each slit coincide. Regions of minimal or no jostling are where peaks from one slit coincide with troughs from the other, resulting in a cancellation. Since the photographic plate records how much it is jostled by the incoming light, exactly the same reasoning applied to the wave picture of a light beam tells us that when both slits are open, the photograph will show a series of light and dark vertical bands. The brightest areas are where light wave peaks, or troughs, from each slit coincide. Dark areas are where wave peaks from one slit coincide with wave troughs from the other, resulting in a cancellation. The sequence of light and dark bands is known as an interference pattern. This is significantly different from Newton's prediction, and hence there is a concrete experiment to distinguish between the particle and the wave pictures of light. Young carried out a version of this experiment, and his results matched the interference pattern, thereby confirming the wave picture. Newton's corpuscular view was defeated, although it took quite some time before physicists accepted this. The prevailing wave view of light was subsequently put on a mathematically firm foundation by Maxwell. But Einstein, the man who brought down Newton's revered theory of gravity, seems now to have resurrected Newton's particle model of light by his introduction of photons. Of course, we still face the same question. How can a particle perspective account for an interference pattern? At first blush, you might make the following suggestion. Water is composed of H2O molecules, the particles of water. Nevertheless, when a lot of these molecules stream along with one another, they can produce water waves with the attendant interference properties. And so, it might seem reasonable to guess that wave properties, such as interference patterns, can arise from a particle picture of light provided a huge number of photons, the particles of light, are involved. In reality, though, the microscopic world is far more subtle. Even if the intensity of the light source is turned down and down, finally to the point where individual photons are being fired one by one at the barrier, say at the rate of 1 every 10 seconds, the resulting photographic plate will still look the same. So long as we wait long enough for a huge number of these separate bundles of light to make it through the slits and to each be recorded by a single dot where they hit the photographic plate, these dots will build up to form the image of an interference pattern. This is astounding. How can individual photon particles that sequentially pass through the screen and separately hit the photographic plate conspire to produce the bright and dark bands of interfering waves? Conventional reasoning tells us that each and every photon passes through either the left slit or the right slit, and we would therefore expect to find the pattern predicted by Newton. But we don't. If you are not bowled over by this fact of nature, it means that either you have seen it before and have become blasé, or the description so far has not been sufficiently vivid. So in case it's the latter, let's describe it again, but in a slightly different way. You close off the left slit and fire the photons one by one at the barrier. Some get through, some don't. The ones that do create an image on the photographic plate, dot by single dot. You then run the experiment again with a new photographic plate, but this time you open both slits. Naturally enough, you think that this will only increase the number of photons that pass through the slits in the barrier and hit the photographic plate, thereby exposing the film to more total light than in your first run of the experiment. But when you later examine the image produced, you find that not only are there places on the photographic plate that were dark in the first experiment and are now bright, as expected, there are also places on the photographic plate that were bright in your first experiment but are now dark. By increasing the number of individual photons that hit the photographic plate, you have decreased the brightness in certain areas. Somehow, temporally separated, individual particulate photons are able to cancel each other out. Think about how crazy this is. Photons that would have passed through the right slit and hit the film in one of the dark bands fail to do so when the left slit is opened, which is why the band is now dark. But how in the world can a tiny bundle of light that passes through one slit be at all affected by whether or not the other slit is open? As Feynman noted, it's as strange as if you fire a machine gun at the screen, and when both slits are open, independent, separately fired bullets somehow cancel one another out, leaving a pattern of unscathed positions on the target, positions that are hit when only one slit in the barrier is open. Such experiments showed that Einstein's particles of light are quite different from Newton's. Somehow photons, although they are particles, embody wave-like features of light as well. The fact that the energy of these particles is determined by a wave-like feature, frequency, is the first clue that a strange union is occurring. But the photoelectric effect and the double-slit experiment really bring the lesson home. The photoelectric effect shows that light has particle properties. The double-slit experiment shows that light manifests the interference properties of waves. Together, they show that light has both wave-like and particle-like properties. The microscopic world demands that we shed our intuition that something is either a wave or a particle and embrace the possibility that it is both. It is here that Feynman's pronouncement that nobody understands quantum mechanics comes to the fore. We can utter words such as wave-particle duality. We can translate these words into a mathematical formalism that describes real-world experiments with amazing accuracy. But it is extremely hard to understand at a deep, intuitive level this dazzling feature of the microscopic world. Matter particles are also waves. In the first few decades of the 20th century, many of the greatest theoretical physicists grappled tirelessly to develop a mathematically sound and physically sensible understanding of these hitherto hidden microscopic features of reality. Under the leadership of Niels Bohr in Copenhagen, for example, substantial progress was made in explaining the properties of light emitted by glowing hot hydrogen atoms. But this, and other work prior to the mid-1920s, was more a makeshift union of 19th-century ideas with newfound quantum concepts than a coherent framework for understanding the physical universe. Compared with the clear, logical framework of Newton's laws of motion or Maxwell's electromagnetic theory, the partially developed quantum theory was in a chaotic state. In 1923, the young French nobleman Prince Louis de Broglie added a new element to the quantum fray, one that would shortly help to usher in the mathematical framework of modern quantum mechanics and that earned him the 1929 Nobel Prize in Physics. Inspired by a chain of reasoning rooted in Einstein's special relativity, de Broglie suggested that the wave-particle duality applied not only to light, but to matter as well. He reasoned, roughly speaking, that Einstein's E equals mc squared relates mass to energy, that Planck and Einstein had related energy to the frequency of waves, and therefore, by combining the two, mass should have a wave-like incarnation as well. After carefully working through this line of thought, he suggested that just as light is a wave phenomenon that quantum theory shows to have an equally valid particle description, an electron, which we normally think of as being a particle, might have an equally valid description in terms of waves. Einstein immediately took to de Broglie's idea, as it was a natural outgrowth of his own contributions of relativity and of photons. Even so, nothing is a substitute for experimental proof. Such proof was soon to come from the work of Clinton Davison and Lester Germer. In the mid-1920s, Davison and Germer, experimental physicists at the Bell Telephone Company, were studying how a beam of electrons bounces off a chunk of nickel. The only detail that matters for us is that the nickel crystals in such an experiment act very much like the two slits in the double-slit experiment, except that a beam of electrons is used in place of a beam of light. We will adopt this point of view. When Davison and Germer examined electrons making it through the two slits in the barrier by allowing them to hit a phosphorescent screen that recorded the location of impact of each electron by a bright dot, essentially what happens inside a television, they found something remarkable. A pattern very much akin to an interference pattern emerged. Their experiment therefore showed that electrons exhibit interference phenomena, the telltale sign of waves. At dark spots on the phosphorescent screen, electrons were somehow canceling each other out, just like the overlapping peak and trough of water waves. Even if the beam of fired electrons was thinned, so that, for instance, only one electron was emitted every 10 seconds, the individual electrons still built up the bright and dark bands, one spot at a time. Somehow, as with photons, individual electrons interfere with themselves in the sense that individual electrons, over time, reconstruct the interference pattern associated with waves. We are inescapably forced to conclude that each electron embodies a wave-like character in conjunction with its more familiar depiction as a particle. Although we have described this in the case of electrons, similar experiments lead to the conclusion that all matter has a wave-like character. But how does this jibe with our real-world experience of matter as being solid and sturdy, and in no way wave-like? Well, de Broglie set down a formula for the wavelength of matter waves, and it shows that the wavelength is proportional to Planck's constant h-bar. More precisely, the wavelength is given by h-bar divided by the material body's momentum. Since h-bar is so small, the resulting wavelengths are similarly minuscule compared with everyday scales. This is why the wave-like character of matter becomes directly apparent only upon careful microscopic investigation. Just as the large value of c, the speed of light, obscures much of the true nature of space and time, the smallness of h-bar obscures the wave-like aspects of matter in the day-to-day world. Waves of what? The interference phenomenon found by Davison and Germer made the wave-like nature of electrons tangibly evident. But waves of what? One early suggestion made by Austrian physicist Erwin Schrödinger was that the waves were smeared out electrons. This captured some of the feeling of an electron wave, but it was too rough. When you smear something out, part of it is here and part of it is there. However, one never encounters half of an electron or a third of an electron, or any other fraction for that matter. This makes it hard to grasp what a smeared electron actually is. As an alternative, in 1926, German physicist Max Born sharply refined Schrödinger's interpretation of an electron wave, and it is his interpretation, amplified by Bohr and his colleagues, that is still with us today. Born's suggestion is one of the strangest features of quantum theory, but is supported nonetheless by an enormous amount of experimental data. He asserted that an electron wave must be interpreted from the standpoint of probability. Places where the magnitude, a bit more correctly the square of the magnitude, of the wave is large are places where the electron is more likely to be found. Places where the magnitude is small are places where the electron is less likely to be found. This is truly a peculiar idea. What business does probability have in the formulation of fundamental physics? We are accustomed to probability showing up in horse races, in coin tosses, and at the roulette table, but in those cases it merely reflects our incomplete knowledge. If we knew precisely the speed of the roulette wheel, the weight and hardness of the white marble, the location and speed of the marble when it drops to the wheel, the exact specifications of the material constituting the cubicles, and so on, and if we made use of sufficiently powerful computers to carry out our calculations, we would, according to classical physics, be able to predict with certainty where the marble would settle. Gambling casinos rely on your inability to ascertain all of this information and to do the necessary calculations prior to placing your bet. But we see that probability, as encountered at the roulette table, does not reflect anything particularly fundamental about how the world works. Quantum mechanics, on the contrary, injects the concept of probability into the universe at a far deeper level. According to Born, and more than half a century of subsequent experiments, the wave nature of matter implies that matter itself must be described fundamentally in a probabilistic manner. For macroscopic objects, like a coffee cup or the roulette wheel, de Broglie's rule shows us that the wave-like character is virtually unnoticeable, and for most ordinary purposes, the associated quantum mechanical probability can be completely ignored. But at a microscopic level, we learn that the best we can ever do is say that an electron has a particular probability of being found at any given location. The probabilistic interpretation has the virtue that if an electron wave does what other waves can do, for instance, slam into some obstacle and develop all sorts of distinct ripples, it does not mean that the electron itself has shattered into separate pieces. Rather, it means that there are now a number of locations where the electron might be found with a non-negligible probability. In practice, this means that if a particular experiment involving an electron is repeated over and over again in an absolutely identical manner, the same answer for, say, the measured position of an electron will not be found over and over again. Rather, the subsequent repeats of the experiment will yield a variety of different results with the property that the number of times the electron is found at any given location is governed by the shape of the electron's probability wave. If the probability wave, more precisely the square of the probability wave, is twice as large at location A than at location B, then the theory predicts that in a sequence of many repeats of the experiment, the electron will be found at location A twice as often as at location B. Exact outcomes of experiments cannot be predicted. The best we can do is predict the probability that any given outcome may occur. Even so, as long as we can determine mathematically the precise form of probability waves, their probabilistic predictions can be tested by repeating a given experiment numerous times, thereby experimentally measuring the likelihood of getting one particular result or another. Just a few months after de Broglie's suggestion, Schrödinger took the decisive step toward this end by determining an equation that governs the shape and the evolution of probability waves, or as they came to be known, wave functions. It was not long before Schrödinger's equation and the probabilistic interpretation were being used to make wonderfully accurate predictions. By 1927, therefore, classical innocence had been lost. Gone were the days of a clockwork universe whose individual constituents were set in motion at some moment in the past and obediently fulfilled their inescapable, uniquely determined destiny. According to quantum mechanics, the universe evolves according to a rigorous and precise mathematical formalism, but this framework determines only the probability that any particular future will happen, not which future actually ensues. Many find this conclusion troubling, or even downright unacceptable. Einstein was one. In one of physics' most time-honored utterances, Einstein admonished the quantum stalwarts that God does not play dice with the universe. He felt that probability was turning up in fundamental physics because of a subtle version of the reason it turns up at the roulette wheel, some basic incompleteness of our understanding. The universe, in Einstein's view, had no room for a future whose precise form involves an element of chance. Physics should predict how the universe evolves, not merely the likelihood that any particular evolution might occur. But experiment after experiment, some of the most convincing ones being carried out after his death, convincingly confirm that Einstein was wrong. As the British theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking has said, on this point, Einstein was confused, not the quantum theory. Nevertheless, the debate about what quantum mechanics really means continues unabated. Everyone agrees on how to use the equations of quantum theory to make accurate predictions, but there is no consensus on what it really means to have probability waves, nor on how a particle chooses which of its many possible futures to follow, nor even on whether it really does choose or instead splits off like a branching tributary to live out all possible futures in an ever-expanding arena of parallel universes. These interpretational issues are worthy of a book-length discussion in their own right, and, in fact, there are many excellent books that espouse one or another way of thinking about quantum theory. But what appears certain is that no matter how you interpret quantum mechanics, it undeniably shows that the universe is founded on principles that, from the standpoint of our day-to-day experiences, are bizarre. The meta-lesson of both relativity and quantum mechanics is that when we deeply probe the fundamental workings of the universe, we may come upon aspects that are vastly different from our expectations. The boldness of asking deep questions may require unforeseen flexibility if we are to accept the answers.